Good evening. This is Dan with the Little Saigon Report for February the 4th, 2019. And just to let you know, we had some snow today in Seattle. It's gotten kind of cold. Even, you know, yesterday or the day before, but definitely yesterday, it was still relatively warm out. But definitely the day before, and now it's in the 20s and 30s, and yeah, I don't care. It's fine. The only nasty thing about this is it looks like the cold's going to stay with us through the month, and I will probably be homeless within a couple weeks, which is fine. I have a job interview tomorrow. Might get rescheduled for Wednesday, but it's kind of like it's kind of like in high school. If you apply to one college, you know, especially if you apply to the best college, you're basically doing something they used to call suiciding, and in this case, it's not so much that I'm not trying to find work, but it's just one of those things. If you work in software in the Seattle area as a contractor, under normal circumstances for the last decade or so, December and January can be very difficult months to find work, especially, you know, and so if you're between contracts, let's say at the end of October or November, It can be kind of a harsh little winter, which means you should do the best you can to save as much money as you can. And I don't know. That's as much as I want to say about that. Hopefully, by the time I hit the streets here in a week or so, the weather will change a bit. But the topic for tonight is not impending homelessness or other choices of existence. Not that it matters. Everybody has their shit. Even the rich people have problems, you know? I mean, I don't know what their problems are. Maybe it's deciding how to fuck with people next. I mean, I suppose if you have a giant menu of fucking with people, you know, it gets really challenging after a while, selecting how you're gonna fuck with the human race. So that's a real problem. And I feel really sorry for those people. The topic for tonight, and I do not know how long-winded it's going to be, is Donald Trump and the wars in the Middle East. Just so you know, if you don't know already, I did not vote for Donald Trump. I did not vote for Hillary Clinton. In 2016, I decided, for the last time in my life and forever, not that it matters, given my future and other people's future, I was never going to vote again. Under the most ideal circumstances, voting is an act of violence against your neighbor. If you believe it is a situation where all parties end up okay at the end of the day, it's really not. You know, yeah, I guess sometimes people have the luck for voting for things that might be innocuous, but in America today, it's usually voting for some policy where someone gets a handout and somebody else gets fucked. And I'm not a big fan of delegating violence. If you're going to take violence against your neighbor, which you shouldn't do, you might as well have the fucking moral courage to do it directly. But this is a country of cowards now. And voting to get shit done and then having some cop or some, you know, militarized security group make, you know, enforce the law for you to make sure the law is implemented. That's the American way now. It's not about freedom or liberty or dignity. That's old times. So no, I did not vote for Trump. I was not optimistic about Trump. When I first saw Trump on the radar in 2015, well, here's what I will say. In 2015, which means, you know, more than a year before the election, I was 100% convinced that there was no way in hell Hillary was going to win an election. And it wasn't because I didn't think she was capable. The system's broken. If the system wanted Hillary to be president, I'm not trying to be an ass, but she would be the president. It's not about that. It's about picking some particular actor who's going to satiate and manage the pent-up animal spirits of the American populace. And in 2008, when the system was melting down, and our government was writing the largest checks to the richest people that ever lived, basically rewarding them for an economic apocalypse, which I don't even know what moral universe that makes sense. But in 2008, they had Obama, and Obama was magical, and he was semi-articulate, and he was kind of good-looking, if you're into that kind of thing. I'm not. His wife, who may or may not be female, seemed okay. And they were black, and so it was also fashionable, and so Cosby Show. And so, yeah, in 2008, the bromide, the drug that was going to be injected into the American populace to keep them from going crazy, was named Barack Hussein Obama. And so in 2015, I was convinced Hillary could not win. But when Trump showed up, I was kind of skeptical. It seemed like at the time, and I remember interacting on Twitter with people about this, it seemed like at the time, Trump's purpose was to be a kind of stalking horse or barrier or guard, that his entire purpose might be to clear the deck of Republican candidates and then implode sometime in early 2016, opening up the path for Jeb Bush. It's not because I like Jeb Bush. Again, I don't like any of these people, and the Bushes I hate the most. If all the Bushes could be hung and sent to hell to spend time with their, you know, their father, their patriarch, who's already burning in hell, George Herbert Walker Bush, and, you know, and hello, George, you know, just to let you know, if I kill myself, I'm going to see you. Because suicides don't go to heaven, but yeah, I would be okay if the entire Bush family was necklaced, a la Winnie Mandela and the ANC in the 1980s. I would be okay if the entire fucking Bush family had a tire put around them, filled the tire with gasoline, and set them on fire. I don't know if I would do it or not, or support it or not, but I gotta be honest with you. If somebody got a hold of that whole fucking family and trapped them in a church and set the church on fire, I wouldn't get sad about it. It wouldn't be a great tragedy. These are people that have been setting fire to the world for several fucking decades. These are people who are either directly or indirectly responsible for the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people. And you could say, well, their children are not responsible. Fine. Keep their children out of it. But as far as the Bush sons go, the sons involved in government, you know, George W. and Jeb and all the other fucking Bushes that, you know, have been involved in government, they can be locked in the fucking church and visit their father. That's how I feel about that. So yeah, when Trump first arrived, I had no idea what to think about that guy. To me, he's always seemed like a crony businessman, a crony buffoon. There's nothing about him that exemplifies authentic entrepreneurship. He exemplifies the worst features of business in America today. He exemplifies the pump and dump, the LLC bankruptcy scam. He exemplifies the way that rich people make money off of everybody else by having more lawyers and thereby basically having more weapons in a legal sense. He's not someone to look up to. He's not a hero. That was my feeling in 2015. And I still basically feel the same way. I understand why people voted for him. It was like, you know, it's like choosing between cancer and AIDS. You know, let's say you had to choose between liver cancer and AIDS, okay? Acquired immune deficiency syndrome. I mean, or actually a better comparison would be liver cancer and Ebola. Because, you know, even Ebola, you have at least a kind of maybe 30% chance of living in many cases. So yeah, if you had to choose between liver cancer and Ebola, you probably, if you were smart, you would choose Ebola, because at least you have some likelihood of surviving. With liver cancer, it's pretty fucking grim. So if Hillary Clinton was liver cancer and Trump was Ebola, I get it. I understand. If you're a voter, if you enjoy voting, if you think voting makes the world a better place, and you feed the little crocodile and say, well, I know the government crocodile is probably evil, but maybe we'll put him on a diet like with Rand Paul or something. Fine, I get it. I get why you voted for Trump. But I actually never thought he would be the Republican nominee, because I myself had kind of been caught up in the narrative. But by the time it became clear that he was going to be the nominee, by the time it became clear that, you know, yeah, even Jeb Bush jumped out of the race, then it was like, okay, this is what it looks like to me. It looked like to me in 2016 that the system was doing for the GOP what they did for the Democrats. They were providing a magical candidate, a hero on a white horse, you know. Trump was, and I think still is, for the right wing in the United States, what Obama was for the left wing, a kind of salve, a kind of way to calm the nerves. Well, at least my guy's in charge. And, you know, you might keep thinking that people can't be fooled indefinitely. I mean, there is that Lincoln quote, you can't fool, you know, everybody all the time. But you can fool people, a lot of people, for a long enough time. You can, in fact, fool everybody for a certain amount of time. And I think Trump and Obama represent that kind of flim-flam or grift. So yes, Trump seemed like an Obama-type person. But the other thing is this. When it became clear that Trump was going to win, and I think it became clear to me, you know, when Hillary was basically shoved into the forefront of the Democratic Party, when Bernie Sanders' campaign was torpedoed in the most obvious form of, you know, political chicanery and probably illegal political activity on the part of the Democratic Party, I knew that Hillary wasn't going to win. Hillary was not the salve. I think even Hillary knew this. If you actually saw some of her speeches from 2016, she was not enthusiastic. She wasn't really a very interesting candidate. She basically looked like somebody heading towards the gallows. So you could almost tell by just listening to Hillary that she knew she wasn't going to win. She knew. She understood she wasn't going to win. So here we are. We have Trump in office. And I was reading an article today by Tom Luongo. I think he's Guns, Goats, and Gold is his kind of, I don't know, nom de plume or whatever. But yeah, Tom Luongo of Gold, Goats, and Guns. If you go to YouTube and type in Gold, Goats, and Guns, you'll probably find some of his videos. But I was listening to, I read this article from Tom Luongo on Zero Hedge, and he's sort of looking at the situation in Syria and the situation when you look at it in the context of Israel. And so last month, during the beginnings of the government shutdown, it looked like Trump was serious about removing forces from Syria. Again, I didn't vote for Trump, but if you told me that a president was going to end a war, it would be like telling me that next year the House and the Senate will pass no laws, they'll only repeal laws. I mean, that would be, you know, that's not really, I mean, an anarchist would prefer if the government disappeared, but if the government started repealing stuff and not adding stuff, that would be kind of like a little bit of anarchist Christmas. And so the troops coming home for the anti-war movement and for people like myself to be intellectually consistent, you have to support that. I totally support ending these stupid fucking wars. They are horrific. They are a sin against every American. If you are so deluded to believe that you're just, well, I'm just paying taxes and I'm a nobody, guess what? All these sins are on you, and you better hope there is no God. Of all the hopes you have as an American these days, you should fucking hope there is no God, because if there is a God, we are in for a lot of fucking trouble in this country. We have run up a bill on our collective souls that is so high, I do not see how we pay it off. But let's sort of flip the script a little. Tom Luongo is one of those folks that voted for Trump, and a lot of people did. Like I said, they chose Ebola, you know, or herpes C, or, you know, something else kind of horrible over stage 4 cancer. I understand. If you had a choice between Ebola or stage 4 cancer, you probably would take your chances with Ebola. I get why you voted for Trump. But he's being very honest, and I kind of like the guy, and he's talking through the thing, well, I voted for him, but it looks like he's, you know, he's being manipulated, or being his, you know, his arm is being twisted. Because about a month ago, it looked like we were going to remove troops from Syria. And then just this last weekend, Trump comes out and says, well, you know, we have to defend Israel and we have to keep the troops there. And don't even get me started on the situation in Venezuela. No, I do not like Maduro. I don't like socialism. But I even hate more than Maduro and socialism the socialist bullshit of the military-industrial complex and the desire to use violence and force to steal other people's shit. That's very much what socialists do. Socialists are looters. If we go into Venezuela and topple their government, like we did in Libya, so we can steal their resources, no matter how you feel about socialists, that's as bad or worse. We're scumbags. We're not heroes. I do not care if Maduro is a piece of shit. Venezuela is for Venezuelans. If the fucking stupid-ass argument that Democrats have been making for 24 months is that Putin and the Russians have been trying to topple our democracy, what the fuck business do we have in Venezuela? What the fuck business do we have telling them they can't trade bonds, that they can't use financial instruments to carry on an economy? Again, I'm expecting a level of intellectual consistency from really stupid people. But think about this for a second. You as a Democrat have spent the last 2 years in a conniption, okay, in a fit over Russians under your bed trying to manipulate American democracy. If you turn on any show, especially Netflix, and it's recent, there's going to be a little Russian subtext about the evil Russians. Even the latest season of The Punisher on Netflix, it's why I couldn't get past the fifth or sixth episode, I wanted to vomit, has the whole, you know, in addition to Christians being evil, has the whole, well, the fucking Russians, they're destroying our democracy. Well, you know, maybe we shouldn't do that either. Maybe we shouldn't topple governments either. Maybe toppling Gaddafi, who was not some great person, but was certainly better than what they have now in Libya, maybe that was wrong as well. Maybe trying to topple Assad is wrong. So here's Trump a month ago saying, we're going to pull out troops. And here last weekend, he says, well, you know, we can't pull out troops. We have to stay there. So let's suppose, flipping the script, that Trump was legit. I don't think he's a good guy. I mean, I know that there are people who have a road, you know, on the road to Damascus moment, like Saul, who became Paul. They are committing evil. They're persecuting Christians. And so on the road to Damascus, they are visited by Christ, and Christ changes their ways. So it's possible. I don't think it's likely. But it's possible that Trump had a road to Damascus moment. And so let's assume that's true, that he's a corrupt business guy, a crony, kind of a terrible person in many dimensions, but he got into the race to try to do something right. Well, it doesn't really explain his flip-flopping unless you consider the following, that he has been pressured. AIPAC, which is the American-Israeli Political Action Committee or something, but AIPAC is one of the biggest lobby groups in the country. AIPAC lobbies for Israel. And it looks like AIPAC is putting on a full court press to stop this. You know, what they wanted was Assad out of Syria, and it looks like Assad has been given a lifeline. It looks like the Russians have been able to put up an air defense network above Syria that basically raises the stakes for Israel. If Israel attacks Syria now, they have a very good chance of losing aircraft and that becoming a war, not just between Syria and Israel, but between Russia and Israel. So this is the question. What was Donald told? You know, if you go back in American history, you don't have to go back that far, but if you go back to the early 60s, you'll remember there was a president by the name of John F. Kennedy. And John F. Kennedy, you know, was probably not a perfect person either. In his personal life, yeah, he probably fucked women. I think we probably have gotten over that by now, one would hope, given all the shit that comes out about every other Democrat or Republican every other week. I mean, at some point, we should just accept that these politicians are very corrupt people for the most part. But yeah, JFK might not have been perfect, but there were some things that JFK wanted to do. He wanted to control the Federal Reserve. He felt the Federal Reserve had too much power over our economy, over our life. So he wanted to issue currency from the Treasury. Now, I don't want to get into whether that would have been better or worse, but He did try to do it. There were actual dollars issued by the Treasury in the early 1960s, actual currency that was not issued by the Federal Reserve. He tried to stop, basically to end the reign of the CIA, to end covert operations, to make American foreign policy public again, that it was not right for us to carry on basically subversive foreign policy. In fact, JFK would have said, it is not right for the US to topple other governments to influence their elections. I mean, you think about this. This is where things get really funny. This is a Democrat who was deeply opposed to the US government and Americans and their organizations impacting the democratic choices of other countries. Wow, when have you ever heard that one before, you fucking Russiagate morons? Ugh. But consistency ought not to be expected these days, or any type of ability to maintain two thoughts in the head at the same time, right? Yeah, so here we are. What was Trump told? I mean, there's been this kind of semi-popular urban legend in the conspiracy community for many, many years since the assassination of JFK, that there is a series of films at the ballistic angle, meaning the angle of the shooters that killed JFK, that they show a president. And they say, look at this film we have. They bring him over to Langley. The CIA invites him in, sits him down, say, hey, watch this film, President Trump. Isn't that funny? Yeah, that's not the movie people see. This is the movie from the gun angle. Of all the things JFK wanted to do, JFK wanted to end the Vietnam War. Before it really took off, he wanted to end the escalation. So the point I'm trying to make is, what if Trump was threatened? I said this in 2016 on Twitter before I was banned, and I'll say it to anybody who's willing to listen. Any president at this point in American history who wants to, basically reverse the direction of empire is going to get killed. Okay? Giant crocodiles only know how to get crazier. They don't lose weight. They don't go on diets. The crocodile of government isn't going to say, well, I need to go on a diet and lose weight. That's never going to fucking happen. They don't stop killing and murdering. It's what the crocodile knows how to do. It's what the government knows how to do. It doesn't know how to do anything else but use force. And war and government, I mean, that's like bacon and eggs, folks. You really can't have government without war. And you really can't have war without government. I mean, you can have violence without government, but the organized mass violence of huge armies, you pretty much need a government for that shit. So I don't know what's going on in Trump land. I know there are a lot of Trump supporters who are getting more and more confused. They're getting sucked into this weird universe where they have to do the same thing that Democrats are doing these days, try to maintain more than one thought in their head at the same time when the two or more thoughts might contradict each other. It's kind of like the Democrat who screams and yells about Putin influencing the 2016 election, but they're okay with us, going into Libya and toppling Gaddafi, or back in the 90s under Clinton, going into Russia and using the United States political system to influence their elections. This is a matter of public record. How do Democrats maintain those thoughts in their head? How do Democrats who support toppling Maduro today in Venezuela, okay, whether you like him or not, he is their current leader, whatever that means, okay? How do you as a Democrat support that and at the same time say, well, Putin's so evil? And even more to the point, how do you support what we've been doing to Syria? Bashar Assad, I don't, again, I'm an anarchist, so I don't want a ruler, but Bashar Assad was known for a very long time as one of the few moderate leaders in the Middle East. Other than quote unquote, our baby doll Israel, which, boy, that's a topic for another podcast. Syria was considered to be a reasonably well-run country. Was it perfect? No. But Christians were safe there. Arabs were safe there. A lot of people were safe in Syria without having to worry about being murdered or buried alive or having their heads cut off. So how do Democrats who are so angry about Putin and Russia and Trump, how do they explain Syria? That somehow there's a magical ethical system that shifts from land to land? How does that work? In 2014, the U.S. government directed a coup in the Ukraine. We toppled an elected president in the Ukraine. How do Democrats, who are so angry about Putin, how do they process that in their brain? Obama was president in 2014. The CIA and NGOs went into the Ukraine and toppled an elected president. I don't give a fuck if you like the person or not. That's for Ukraine to decide, not you, motherfucker. You don't have a right to decide that. You're an American. You should fix your house first. Clean your house first. You see homeless people in the street, why don't you help them first before you worry about homeless people 1,000 or 2,000 or 10,000 miles away? And again, I'm expecting a kind of intellectual consistency here that may no longer exist. Trump has a State of the Union tomorrow. I think that's going to be interesting. I do not know what to expect. I am wary of listening to it because I no longer have any investment or interest in the American political system, but beyond Schadenfreude, beyond just being morbidly curious about the slow motion train wreck, which might actually become a fast train wreck of the American empire. But it does look really strange. The whole thing looks strange. You know, Trump might be someone who on the road to Damascus decided that he was going to try to do the right thing. But that just means he's a fool. No, the empire is never going to go backwards. The empire will collapse. The empire will crash. The empire will go up in flames. But the empire itself is not going to voluntarily say we're going backwards. Not unless it's pushed to a point where it knows it's all over anyways. I mean, think about 1989. In 1989, the Soviet military left Afghanistan. Within a few months, the Berlin Wall fell. Within a few years, the Soviet Union as we know it ceased to exist. So what we know about empires historically is they don't voluntarily stop being empires. They simply start failing. They start crashing. They start collapsing. That's what's going to happen to us. If we're really, really lucky, and I mean really lucky, and I don't think we're going to be this lucky, if we're really lucky, the United States experiences something like what the Soviet Union went through in the early 90s. For people in the United States, it could be pretty rough economically, it could be rough socially, but it doesn't have to be the end of the world. And that's if we're really lucky. It could be many, many years of a lot of pain and a lot of chaos. And even the United States, continentally speaking, the 50 states might not survive it, not to mention the territories. We could end up more than one country in a decade or two. And that's the best case scenario. The worst case scenario is that the empire goes down the way many, many empires do. In fact, I would argue most empires go down, and that is in war. And I mean major war. I don't mean little wars that cost the lives of a few thousand Americans. That's what we've been experiencing since 9/11. I mean wars like World War I. World War I had many causes, but one of its causes was the decline of empires, the decline of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the decline of the Russian Empire, and the decline of the Ottoman Empire, which we now know is what's left of it is Turkey. Those empires were in decline, and while they were in decline, they were trying to fight fires, as empires often do, and fighting fires for an empire means waging war. If we're really lucky, in a few years, life could be really tough for most, if not all, Americans. Not that it's not already tough for most Americans, but I mean a lot worse. You know, there are levels. There's a story, and again, it might be apocryphal, but it was a story that came up in a graduate course in Russian history that I was taking many, many years ago. And it concerns the months following Pearl Harbor. So for those of you who don't know, the war, or the portion of World War II that involved the Soviet Union and Nazi Germany, didn't start until June 22nd, 1941. Up until that point, the Soviet Union and the Nazis were more or less, if not allies, they were kind of in a stable state. You know, something a lot of people don't realize for political reasons, because God forbid the lefties at the university tell you the truth, but a lot of Americans don't realize, or never taught, that when the Nazis invaded Poland in 1939, the Soviet Union also invaded Poland. Oh, so sorry to fucking shake your fucking stupid world. The communists and the Nazis started World War II. Okay? I know that that's shocking for you, and it's really hard if you're a Democrat and a lefty and a communist to process this, but the communists and the Nazis both invaded Poland per an agreement between Hitler and Stalin in 1939. In 1941, that agreement ended, and Hitler invaded the Soviet Union. So a few months into the war, after some major crises passed, and I would say we're talking 1942, Stalin is sitting down at a meeting and he says, you know, now that America's kind of an ally of ours and providing weapons so we can fight the Nazis, why don't we let in some American culture? And so they decided they would let in some American movies. And one of the movies that was presented for Stalin, because it seemed like about the only movie they could show for propaganda reasons, was a version of Steinbeck's The Grapes of Wrath. And so Stalin is watching this movie, The Grapes of Wrath, and he's watching the family, I always forget their name, but the Okies or whatever, the Oklahoma family that was moving to California, in their vehicle with all their stuff piled high in their truck. And Stalin stopped the film and he said, no. He said, listen, are you telling me that during one of the worst periods in modern economic history, the poorest Americans still had gasoline and vehicles to drive around in? Now, you may not get this, but during the 1920s, during the Civil War in Russia, there was cannibalism. There was so much starvation, people were eating each other. So Stalin, who was, involved in the Civil War, he would look at this movie and say, so you're saying that Tom Joad and his family had a vehicle? These are the poorest Americans. They have a truck filled with shit to drive around in and the money for gasoline. Stalin's point was really quite simple. Americans don't really know or understand pain, not the way a lot of other countries do. The last time most Americans, or at least Americans per se, experienced that kind of deprivation was the American Civil War. Okay, that's when the war was here and real for people. That's when actual cities in America were set on fire. If we're really, really lucky, and I mean really lucky, we'll experience a soft collapse. I just don't think we'll be that lucky. The kind of warmongering going on right now seems to be pointing in one direction. I mean, here's Trump saying we should move troops out of Syria. That makes common sense. We barely have a couple thousand troops there. That's not even a division. He's saying let's end that activity. Now, maybe it had another agenda so he could move troops to Iraq so he could get ready to invade Iran, which I think is totally likely. I do think that Trump is more or less owned by the Israelis. I do not believe Trump ever had a road to Damascus moment. Most of the chaos you're seeing, I think, is engineered. I think it's propaganda. I think that the people who advise Trump have been advising him quite well on keeping his own supporters confused. It's like the whole Q phenomena, that secret organization sending the truth out on 4chan and 8chan and other secret websites. Not so secret if people can, It's kind of like Khrushchev's secret speech. It's not really secret if everybody knows about it. But yeah, the whole Q thing. I think Trump has advisors who are basically saying, continue a psyop. Keep people confused. Keep them on edge. Keep them thinking that you're trying to follow some eight-dimensional chess to end these wars, while at the same time, prepare for war with Iran. And frankly, other places. That's what I think is more realistic. And here's the thing about war, and And this is what a lot of people don't get until it's too late. Wars are a lot like setting controlled fires. And sometimes, if you're really skilled, you can set a controlled fire and you can keep it under control. It's kind of like, you know, when the Forest Service starts a fire, burns part of a, you know, a national park in order to prevent a bigger fire from taking over. That's part of the theory of modern war. You fight wars to prevent bigger wars. It's insane. It's crazy. It only works until it doesn't. And it really only works if you're the most powerful bully out there. I mean, bullies, it is true that the most powerful bully in the schoolyard can usually maintain a kind of quasi-peace. I mean, it's not peace from the perspective of the kids getting beaten up every other day, but from the perspective of the entire schoolyard being up in arms, it's a kind of quasi-peace. I mean, if you're a country in Africa or the Middle East that's being bombed by the U.S., it's not peace. So if you're one of these kids in the schoolyard who gets his money taken, his lunchbox money, or his lunch itself, or gets punched in the face, or gets a swirly, or gets a head dunked in the toilet, from the perspective of that kid being picked on, it's very much like war. But if you look at the schoolyard as a whole, the bullies maintain a kind of quasi-stability. But that only works if you truly are, A, the strongest bully out there, and B, that others, either singly or as a group, are unable to act out against you. And this is, and I don't want to go into a long, drawn-out discussion of game theory, but a lot of game theory deals with the topic of stability in the game itself. A stable game is a game that has mathematical solutions for prediction. For example, in the Prisoner's Dilemma, which is a two-person game theory model, there is a mathematical solution called Nash equilibrium, based upon the famous mathematician by the name of Nash. And according to Nash equilibrium, there is a predicted outcome and there's an optimal outcome. Now, they might not, the predicted and the optimal aren't always the same. In fact, in the case of the Prisoner's Dilemma, they're actually the opposite. But the point that Nash makes is that in these games, at least you can predict either one or the other, which means these are the two possibilities. You know, either the prisoners, the two prisoners, you know, both give up the goods on each other, or they both keep their mouths shut, or one of them talks. But the point is, the outcomes are predictable. There is a stable linear solution. In real world involving multiple countries, which means more than two parties, you're not dealing with two-person game theory, you're dealing with something called n-person game theory. And in n-person game theory, you have a phenomena that in mathematical terms is a lot like an n-by-n matrix that does not have a reduced echelon form. Or another way of saying this, in n-person game theory, you do not have a linear solution. You have a universe of not so great solutions, which means if I have, let's say I have two lines, like let's say I have two linear functions, okay? And they both are different from each other, which means by definition, if I have two lines on a plane, and the functions that define the lines are different, which means, let's say one is 2x and one is 3x. Somewhere in the plane, if x is big enough, the two lines are going to intersect. And at that intersection point, you have a solution to both equations. That is the ideal situation for two-person game theory. Again, it's idealized because it's just not reality. But let's say I have three functions. If I have three functions, 2n, 3n, 4n, and again, I don't want to go into whether you can find a point where these three intersect. I don't think they do. But if I have three functions, the likelihood that you're going to find a linear solution that meets all three reduces. And as the number of functions increases, the likelihood of finding a linear solution drops. That is the reality of foreign policy in the world today. The people, the kids in the schoolyard, A, no longer trust the bully to practice any kind of common sense, and B, they're all starting to look at each other and say, you know what, by ourselves, we can't really hurt the bully. But if two or three or four of us start ganging up on the bully, things get really tough for the bully really fucking fast. The chickens are coming home to roost, folks, one way or another. And if you're a real radical conspiracy theorist, more paranoid than I am, you could argue the whole thing is contrived. Like, you could say, well, Putin and Xi and China and, you know, Modi and India, and Pakistan and Israel, all these countries are working together. There is only one government, it's a shadow government. I don't really believe that. I think that there are people in the world who'd like to have one world government, but I'm not really sure it really exists yet. I think that they're attempting it, right? But really, I think it's really just a bunch of criminals. And so at that level, you have lots of criminals competing for resources. Right now in Venezuela, you have Russia and China. Russia and China have investments in Venezuela. If the United States goes in there with either direct military force or what we're currently doing, indirect assuasion, which really means the use of the CIA and economic warfare to topple the Maduro government, if we do that, we're threatening billions and billions of dollars in investments of the Chinese and the Russians. What do we think they're going to do? Do we think they're just going to stand by and say, okay? I mean, sure, you know, you basically are a bully and you steal our lunch money and you act like a dick and you step on our sandwiches every 5 minutes, but yeah, go ahead and topple Venezuela. So I don't know about Trump. If he had a road to Damascus moment, if he had a moment where he said in 2016, you know, I'm running because I believe in America and I want to make it great again and these wars are stupid, it might be the case. I don't really believe it. But even if it were the case, I stick to my guns, like I said in 2016. If he is legit, he's dead. Just like JFK. The more legit a person is on trying to achieve a soft landing for an empire, the more likely that person's going to be killed. Or, or something to that effect. And so have a great Monday evening, you know. Make sure you watch the State of the Union tomorrow. It'll probably be entertaining one way or another. And good night.